This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Libby returns on Monday. And be sure to stick around for the whole hour of Fight Back today, as we have special programming in the second half on the importance of vaccinations as we age. Olivia Chow does not very often visit individual radio or television stations due to her busy schedule as Toronto's mayor, but she made an exception for us today on the morning Zoom with Sam and Jane here on Zoomer Radio. We talked about her plans for the city, including today's announcement of 1,000 new and improved sidewalk litter bins, how she wants to implement more provisions around aging at home for Toronto elders, and how she plans to tackle the never-ending construction in Toronto. In fact, she offered us a tease of a coming announcement around closing down roads.
If you want to close the road, if it's a private contractor, good. But if you do it faster, we'll charge you less. If you do it slower, we'll charge you more because you're closing the street. So that kind of congestion pricing, we've never used it before. But of course, so I'm asking them to plan for it. That isn't out there yet, but that will come.
Mayor Chow also reiterated what she said last week about moving toward 24/7 construction on the Gardiner between Dufferin and Strawn so the rehabilitation can be completed before the current 3-year time frame. And she gave us a little hint on how to access Hyde Park with a vehicle, even though the park is off limits to cars during the cherry blossom bloom and on weekends. Is Mayor Chow doing a good job? 52% of respondents to a recent survey say yes. What do you think? 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
And now it's time to tune into the town.
Our Tune Into the Town municipal panel is Alex Blumenstein, co-founder of The Peak, Karen Stintz, CEO of Variety Village, and David Crombie, former mayor of Toronto, among many other accomplishments. Hello to you all.
Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
Well, Karen, I'll start with you, since you were a longtime city councillor. What do you think of that idea, incentivizing private contractors by charging them less if they take less time?
Oh, I think it's a great idea because, you know, as we know, if we drive through the city, there's hardly a street you can go down that isn't blocked for some reason. And, you know, given the amount of construction, condo construction in the city, it's usually blocked because of a developer needing that lane to put up their condo. And so we need the houses. We need them quickly. And I, you know, again, I don't know what the developer feedback on this is going to be, whether it's doable or not. But I certainly think that if we can provide incentives for to the development community to, you know, encourage the construction in a timely manner and to free up that street because we are, you know, limiting capacity, I think it's a great idea.
David, I'm surprised no one came up with it sooner.
No, I agree with what Karen said. And I think maybe people may have mentioned it before, but it never made the decision room table. So it seems to me that this is a really good move. And it reminds me that I think the mayor is doing a really good job.
Okay, and what do you think? 416-360-0740. What about you, Alex, the idea of charging these private developers?
Yeah, it seems kind of obvious. And, you know, I'm very pro-construction, pro-growth. But at the same time, these builders aren't doing it out of the kindness of their hearts. It is a profitable endeavor for them. So they should, you know, pay for the public cost of what they're doing. And this gives me the opportunity to, you know, grind an axe that I have, which is there's where I live at Bloor and Dufferin. There's a massive construction project happening, and that's all fine. But there's also a lot of foot traffic there going to the mall, going to a subway station. And because of that, there's basically a double wide sidewalk. And they've only built a half wide scaffolding. So it just limits the amount of pedestrian traffic that can go through there. And I think that's a massive oversight by the developer there. And they should have to do something about that.
Yeah, I would think that especially private contractors would be motivated by having to pay the city mm-hmm. less money if they could go a little faster. So that's an idea that has been floated and sounds like it is going to be introduced by the mayor in the coming days or weeks. We saw her out front this morning after she visited us here at the Zoomerplex out front of Nathan Phillips Square introducing the new garbage bins. Let's all diss about these horrible garbage bins. Karen, it seems to me that it was a huge mistake to get into business with Astral to make these things.
Yeah, you know, I was on council at the time, and I will actually also point out that so was Mayor Chow as a city councillor. So, you know, we did make the decision, and at the time it was seen as a public-private partnership that would help the city get new bins in exchange for letting Astral have greater advertising opportunities. And so, you know, 17 years ago, it seemed like a way to engage with the private sector. And of course, hindsight is always 20/20, but I'm not sure the bins delivered on everything that we expected, in fairness. And so I think that the opportunity to reconfigure those bins is, you know, because they're old.
Yeah.
They're 17 years old. So I think it's time. And, you know, my hope is that when, you know, when they get replaced, that we've learned a little bit in the last 17 years about how to not recreate what we did, but actually improve upon it.
And yeah, I can see why the deal was done. But in terms of these actual sidewalk bins that accept garbage and recycling, they are just not user friendly. Do you remember, Karen, any concerns around that?
No, there was a bit, there was accessibility concerns, most definitely. But, you know, and I think that the view was that the bins were supposed to encourage recycling and encourage and people not to generate waste. And so, you know, again, with the city, they were trying to do too many things with the idea of a garbage bin, and it didn't play out very well.
Right. David, what are your thoughts on these garbage bins? I mean, literally nobody wants to touch them, let alone put their hand in the hole to put the garbage in there.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. A long time since there should have been the change back to, in a sense, where we were. It's not a small thing. It defines that whether or not the street is messy when you get there, it defines very much your own behavior to it. And so what it does is not only make a blight on the place, but it contributes to other people thinking it's okay. So this is a really good move, and I'm glad they're doing it.
Alex, what do you think about these garbage bins? Not user-friendly. There's that whole broken glass theory that if something looks messy, it's just going to get messier. If it looks clean, we're going to want to keep it clean.
For sure. And this feels like a very Toronto problem where we look for our own made-at-home solution when there are plenty of solutions already available. Garbage cans have existed for a long time, and other cities have ones that are effective in accomplishing all of the goals of looking nice, making sure people get rid of their waste. And we just always have to do things different, and that's how we ended up with these that don't work. But it should also be pointed out that part of the agreement with Astral was that they would be responsible for the upkeep of them, and it seems that they really did not do that at all, and the city didn't really have any remedy or use that remedy for it. Maybe Karen knows more about that than I do, but it does seem like that was just left out there and they just didn't hold up their end of the bargain.
Yeah, what about that, Karen, getting out of this 20-year deal 3 years early? Or, well, now it's 3 years until the deal is done, but because they have not lived up to their part of the agreement.
Yeah, and again, I'm removed from the contract and what it says around non-compliance, but it's back to Alex's point. If the city didn't do anything to enforce the terms of the contract, it becomes a bit difficult at this stage of the game to go go back and do anything and get any kind of remedy. So I would say that if we can get some new bins in the next 3 years, we should take advantage of that opportunity. You know, and unfortunately, we've got to simplify the bins, because the reality, I mean, the sad reality is that as much as we try to recycle, the market for recycling is not there anymore. And so while it's a good idea in practice, we just need one garbage can that gets emptied by one truck,
right,
and in the streets. And we just need to accept that reality so that we can get something that's effective and efficient and people will use.
David, what is your experience when you were mayor and in so many other jobs you've done over the years in terms of getting out of an ironclad agreement because the other side's not living up to what they said they would do?
Well, it's never easy to do it. It depends, obviously, on the quality of the agreement and the contract you make. But mostly, most corporations that I recall wanted to do a good job because they had jobs in mind for the future. So I think that was one of the disciplines beyond the contract, is if you're expecting future business, you're going to try and do a good job now. So I think that's where we're having to, in a sense, start over, but that's okay.
I think this is indicative of how Olivia Chow is operating as Toronto's mayor when she told me and Sam this morning on the morning Zoom here that she has spoken with Astral, her people have spoken with Astral, encouraged them to be good corporate citizens, Alex, and that is why they are coming up with the 1,000 bins that have been redesigned.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great deal that she managed to get this, especially as Karen said that it would be hard to actually get any remedy for a breach of contract at this point. We may as well take it. I just think it's like it's a little rich to be like, oh, these good corporate citizens. I don't think we should be applauding them, frankly. I think it's like about time that they stepped up and held up their end of the bargain. Seems like they got a pretty great deal and didn't do what they had to do. So, yeah, let's take the bins. And good for her for getting this done, because they probably could have just coasted at this point.
And on that note, what do you think about how Mayor Olivia Chow is doing during her first 10 months as Toronto's new mayor? We want to hear from you. 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-744-740. A 52% approval rating, Karen, is very high, even though her approval rating right after becoming the mayor was up in the 70s.
Yeah, it is. You know, it is. Mayors typically have an above 50% approval rating, because generally speaking, they're cheerleaders for the city and people want that. And I think she's done some things that people didn't expect, like, you know, being able to get money from the government, being able to work with Doug Ford and uploading the highways and for some small concessions. And, you know, she did implement a tax hike that it was, you know, certainly Torontonians are not used to seeing. And, you know, the bills haven't been sent out yet for the second half of the tax season. So
right.
There's going to be a bit of sticker shock, I think, for a lot of people when they get that bill, because it'll be double-ended. But, you know, by and large, she did inherit, she admittedly inherited a bit of a mess. And it doesn't get fixed overnight. And it looks like she's taking the steps that she needs to get the city back on track.
You know, it's interesting, David. She talked this morning about how she was as a city councillor 30 years ago versus how she is now as mayor. And she used the language saying that she's not as dogmatic as she was back in the day. And it's interesting, all of her negotiations so far with Doug Ford, with members of Trudeau's cabinet, with Trudeau himself, they've gone very well. Somehow she's found a way to connect with these politicians on a different level.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think what she's done is become less ideological. I'll take her word for it. I think that's probably right. I think what also counts for it is she is different from a lot of politics today, which people think blaming the other guy is somehow the right thing to do. You don't hear her blaming other people. And that's it almost stands alone because our politics has become so sharp-edged. So I think it's her style and perhaps a lack of ideology now. She's very pragmatic about it. And her style is even, Stephen, and people respect that.
Right. Alex, you win more friends or you attract more bees with honey, right?
Yeah, I mean, she seems to be quite pragmatic in her approach. She's getting things done. I think her experience at multiple levels of government is coming through and showing. And I think, you know, to maintain a good approval rating as a mayor, I think really comes down to, you know, no major scandals, right? She's not getting into any trouble. So people aren't noticing and people aren't paying attention. You know, we've had a long time of scandals in our past mayor. So I think just not being embarrassed is a pretty good place to be. And that allows her to, you know, have the support of half the city, which is not bad.
And how long is that window, Karen, in your experience, in terms of making sure that Toronto property owners, you, me, that we feel like we're getting value for the extra 9.5% increase?
Yeah, I think that's going to be the real challenge moving ahead, is that people need to start seeing cleaner streets, cleaner parks, and also that they need to have a better sense of safety and security. I mean, the cars are being stolen. Now it's moved to carjacking. People don't really feel safe in their neighborhoods. And that's real. And, you know, the risk to that is that communities begin to become more insular and less generous. And that is a really serious issue for our city. And so she's got to pay attention to those kinds of things, I think, and be able to deliver some real quality improvements for how people experience the city. And that's a big challenge because she, you know, she still has people living in parks. There's still a lot of homelessness on the TTC. We're going to have a big tax bill coming in. And unfortunately, there's a cumulative effect, right? So every level of government says, oh, it's just, you know, pennies a day that you're now paying to support your most important services. But the pennies start to add up when each level of government takes that approach and doesn't realize that there's only one person and the pockets are empty and you can't come in, you know, at some point you guys have to figure this out without assuming that I'm an ATM and can fund all of your hopes and dreams.
And David, you know, on the same theme, Mayor Chow has said repeatedly at various announcements and even here at the Zoomerplex today that she inherited a mess. But at what point does that mess become her mess?
Well, that's right. People have short memories for good reason, and that is life changes. All people go through their life cycles and so on. So people actually don't pay attention on a regular basis about how things have gone on. They're actually more interested in seeing basically how you're going to face the problem you've got today and tomorrow and not necessarily how well you did with some of those problems in the past. And I think she's probably alive to that, but it is certainly true that people are looking for what you're going to do, not necessarily giving you a hell of a lot of credit for what you've done.
Right. Okay. It's our Tune Into the Town panel. David Crombie, Karen Stintz, Alex Blumenstein, and you. And I'm waiting for your calls. I guess you all think Mayor Chow is great. Not worth calling in. You agree with most people that she should get a pass and be approved for the job she has done so far. It's not that I only want to hear dissenters, but let's get the phones ringing. What do you think of Mayor Chow? Olivia Chow is the mayor of the biggest city in this country and among the biggest cities in the world. How is she doing 10 months in? If you heard the conversation we had with her on the morning Zoom between 9 and 10 this morning, you got your own impression and we want to hear from you. 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740. Daryl in Toronto, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm getting really tired of hearing this, I inherited this. Inherit is a passive term. Ms. Chow did not inherit this mess. She campaigned for it. She actively went out and asked for it. And I think it was David who said she's not blaming other people. To me, every time she says, I inherited this mess, she's blaming other people. And I think the whole Ontario Place thing is going to come back to haunt her. She basically wrote off any proper scrutiny by the city on that. She sold it out for, you know, what, a couple of highways that he was going to upload anyway. So I'm not terribly in favor of everything she's done.
What do you think about that, Alex? Was he going to upload those anyway?
probably not. I mean, it does seem like a pretty good deal, but I do take the caller's point. I also think, and I know David knows more about this than I do, that she hasn't completely washed her hands of Ontario Place and saying she decided to step down or remove opposition to a certain part of it, but I do believe, and she's not being as vocal, but I don't think the city's completely said, okay, go ahead and take it and turn to the spa. But I think when dealing with the province, the city's hands are tied because the province can just do what they want ultimately. Like, that's what it comes down to. So if you can get something out of them, then take it, because we've seen this particular government say, we're going to do whatever we want with the city. They have all the power.
David, your thoughts on what the caller was saying?
No, I think Alex has it right. The mayor has to live with the province. There's no doubt about that. But also the province, if it's done well, the province gains benefit from making good deals with the city that are important to people in terms of services. And I think Premier Ford understands that. I think it is remarkable that given Ford's style of politics and I think his basic ideology, that he and the mayor figured out ways on a couple of occasions, how do they work for the benefit of the public generally? We deserve to offer applause for that and not just skepticism.
I want to continue hearing from you on these city issues. We'll talk now about a couple of things that we did run by the mayor as well, one of which is High Park access or lack of access for vehicles during the entire time of the cherry bloom and on weekends as well. Now, Karen, you know something about all of this and the long controversy over vehicles, no vehicles in High Park. But Mayor Chow said this morning that you can access with your vehicle the park at a couple of entrances at the south end, and then you can rent a bike or walk into the park. So cars are not completely banned.
Yeah, and I think I remember talking actually with David on this issue, and that, you know, there certainly is, should be consideration for those with mobility issues that can't reasonably get to the park any other way except driving. And It seems to make sense to, you know, to get there and to park and then be able to enjoy the park, I think, is a reasonable accommodation and not one that people will take unless they have to, because, you know, even though that there is entry points there, it's crowded and congested and you're waiting in line and. So I think, you know, by and large, people will get there another way. But if for reasons of mobility or other issues, I think it's reasonable to let people into the park at designated locations in a car.
In a car. Alex, so what are your thoughts on this ongoing issue?
I mean, you can't please everybody. And this is the sort of situation where you're going to have some people who win and some people who will lose. Oftentimes, you know, you do have to protect the minority rights. But in this case, I think it's fine to say more people will benefit from there not being cars allowed in the park than allowing cars in the park. At the same time, having a lot available at the park is different than having cars drive through the park. So that seems perfectly fine. Have some lots available that aren't in the middle of the park to limit the traffic, but still have some parking for those who have mobility issues.
David, is it good enough, the access for vehicles, at least into the edge of the park? Is that good enough? Or are those who are fighting for the High Park access for all, should they keep on fighting?
Well, I guess two things. One, there is no doubt that the park benefits from the policy decisions made to limit its use or limit the use of cars. There's no doubt about that. Secondly, though, that I'm struck with the understanding that for people with disability and older people, flowers and gardens are especially important. And somehow there's got to be some way in which there's a transit system, a little train system. I'm not sure. I should have thought more about it. But I think we should be paying attention to people with disability and older people, and that's a substantial number of people in the city, they like to go to the gardens and see these things. And so we need to find, a bike is not good enough, right? So I hope somebody's putting some energy and thought, whether that's private organizations, community organizations, or the government itself, they need to say, how do we serve people of disability and people who are old who really enjoy flowers and gardens.
Right.
And I don't think we can leave it alone and say, well, too bad.
We will leave that topic there just because of timing, but I do want to get a round table here on the latest efforts by the city to crack down on owners of dangerous dogs. If you've been listening along over the last 24 hours, the city is going to be going door to door to 373 homes where orders on dangerous dogs extend. And it sounds like it is going to be, there is going to be more enforcement and more push for these owners to get their dogs socialized properly, Alex.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a dog person, and I know I don't like the idea of there being dangerous dogs. Like, yeah. I don't want to say what we should do with them, but it seems like a problem that we have these dogs that are labeled as dangerous. This means they've like attacked children, other dogs. It's a bad thing, and it makes me very uncomfortable. And this is just the ones we know about, the ones that have been reported. It's dogs can be dangerous, and of course, people say, "Oh, there's no bad dogs. There's just bad owners." So yeah, let's go after them.
Yeah, Karen, what do you think of from a former city councilor's point of view on this?
Yeah, so this is, I think, a targeted approach, which makes sense. This isn't a blanket approach asking every single dog owner to prove that their dog is not dangerous, which would be, I'd have an issue with that. But for dogs that have been identified as dangerous, for the city to do follow-up, I think is completely appropriate.
And David?
No-brainer for me. If dogs are considered dangerous, and that's already been authenticated, and all it's lacking is enforcement of it, go get them.
All right. That's it for this week and our tune into the Town Municipal Panel. Thank you all for your time, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Karen Stintz, CEO of Variety Village, Alex Blumenstein, co-founder of The Peak, and David Crombie, former mayor of Toronto. It is Jane for Libby here on Zoomer Radio's Fight Back. And coming up next, a very special segment on vaccinations, how staying up to date on your vaccines could help underprivileged children around the world get vaccinated. And we especially want to hear from you during the next half hour around the shingles vaccine, whether you've gotten yours or not. 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Libby is on vacation this week. She is back on Monday. On this National Immunization Awareness Week, the importance of keeping up with our vaccines is top of mind. More than 200 whole health pharmacies are taking part in a campaign called Dose for Dose. They donate up to 30,000 childhood vaccines for measles, polio, and tetanus to UNICEF Canada. And as part of the campaign, they are encouraging Canadians, including older adults, to get their own vaccination, whether it be for meningitis B, HPV, pneumonia, RSV, or shingles, and of course, the COVID vaccine. Joining me for the half hour and to take your calls, and let me remind you of the numbers, 416-360-0740 or 1-866-744-740, is pharmacist Dr. Molly Yang. Dr. Molly Yang, Director of Pharmacy Innovation and Professional Affairs at Whole Health Pharmacy Partners, a national group with over 200 pharmacies across Canada. Dr. Yang, welcome to Zoomer Radio and Fight Back.
Thank you so much, Jane. Thank you for having me on the show.
Let's talk first about this Dose for Dose campaign. Innovative, helpful, inspiring, all of the above.
Yes, thank you, Jane. And first of all, thank you for the great introduction on Whole Health. We are a group of independently owned pharmacies across Canada, and our pharmacies are very focused on providing that exceptional patient care and really embodying what it means to be a local community pharmacy. As you mentioned, this year we are really excited to launch our Dose for Dose program, which is a unique nonprofit campaign in which we're donating up to 30,000 life-saving children's vaccines, including measles, polio, and tetanus vaccines worldwide through UNICEF Canada. All of our Whole Health pharmacies are participating in the campaign.
So will these 30,000 vaccines be donated regardless of the uptake of vaccines here in Ontario and across Canada? Yeah.
That's a great question. So we've pledged to donate up to 30,000 vaccines until March 2025, and we will be taking stock of the amount of vaccines that are given in our pharmacies. And to do that, we're hoping to encourage Canadians locally in our communities to talk to their pharmacists and to healthcare providers about their vaccine. To get those recommended vaccines and protecting themselves, their loved ones, and their families, all while giving back to the global community.
Right. So just by going and getting one of the vaccines I talked about there in the intro, you could be vaccinating a child in a third world nation.
Yes, exactly. For Canadians that perhaps are not yet eligible for any of those vaccines, or if they don't wish to get a vaccine at this time, they can also participate in our Dose for Dose campaign by completing an online educational quiz. And our quizzes, they're administered by our nonprofit partner, iBoost Immunity, and they are linked on our campaign website.
Okay, what kind of questions are in the quiz?
Yeah, so there's a variety of quizzes that individuals can participate in. They're quizzes about general vaccine information, so about HPV, about some of the other topics as well.
Okay, and we talked about the vaccines for those who would like to participate in the Dose for Dose campaign. Meningitis B, HPV, pneumonia, RSV, shingles. Was I right to mention COVID there before, or are we just dealing with that former list?
So we're focusing on the former list, so HPV, meningitis B, pneumonia, RSV, and shingles vaccines. And the reason why is because, you know, over the past few years, Whole Health, we've really focused on adult immunizations, and often these ones are missed. And a lot of the individuals who would benefit from these vaccines maybe aren't aware, and it leads to very big vaccine gaps within our communities.
All right, let's go over them one by one. And I'm speaking with Dr. Molly Yang, Director of Pharmacy Innovation and Professional Affairs at Whole Health Pharmacy Partners. And we will get to your phone calls as well. We have a pharmacy expert here with us for the half hour. So try to grab a line while there are still one or two open. 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740. Let's talk about meningitis B, the vaccine, first.
Yes. So for meningitis B, most people are unaware that there's no real provincial funding for this vaccine. And actually, meningitis B accounts for the majority of cases of bacterial meningitis across Canada. With meningitis B, the population that we typically tend to focus on in pharmacies is younger patients, so patients between 15 to 24, so those are your children, your grandchildren, right, who are at increased risk because they are, you know, living in university dorms. They are participating in behaviors where they're sharing saliva and being very close with other individuals of the same age group. Usually the bacteria, the carriage of this bacteria is common within that age group. And although it is fairly rare to get meningococcal meningitis, the effects can be devastating. So in the past few years, there have been cases of deaths at universities, including Kai Matthews from 2019, who unfortunately passed within 36 hours from getting meningitis B.
So is this something you should be talking to your doctor or pharmacist about if you are out of that 15 to 24 age range, or are you not really at risk to the point where you should get a vaccine?
Yeah, so for meningitis B, we're really mainly focusing within that age range. And the other more important age range is also infants. So infants and then age 15 to 24. So it's important for those listening to think about, you know, especially your children, your grandchildren, those going off to university, to make sure they're protected.
Okay. And what about HPV? I remember when my daughter got the HPV vaccine back when she was in grade 8. And now they offer it to boys as well, yes?
Yes, that's true. With HPV vaccinations, and you're right, Jane, they are offered in school, but a lot of the times parents do have to consent to them. And especially with COVID over the past few years, there were huge gaps in the number, the percentage of eligible children who got these vaccines. So big gaps with HPV as well. And, you know, it's not just for girls, as you mentioned, it's for everyone over the age of 9. So basically, you know, everybody who is sexually active or continues to be or has plans to be sexually active would be at risk of contracting HPV. The majority of us, so about 75 to 80% of Canadians, will contract an HPV infection in our lifetimes. And whether or not that results in the HPV-related cancers that it can cause, including cervical, but also head and neck cancers, especially in people of all genders, including males, that's why it's important to get immunized for HPV.
But what about if you are older and you have multiple sex partners? Should you also be inquiring about the HPV vaccine?
Yes, definitely. You know, I think a lot of people are familiar with NACI now after COVID, but essentially NACI provides guidance for how vaccines should be used in Canada. And they mentioned that, you know, especially for ages 9 to 45, everyone should get vaccinated for HPV. But over the age of 45, if you continue to be at risk of exposure to HPV, then it is important to get protected. So you can speak to your pharmacist, speak to your other trusted healthcare providers about that vaccine.
Okay, our phone lines are jammed. So let's talk about the other three vaccines that are part of the Dose for Dose campaign with Whole Health Pharmacies. The pneumonia vaccine, tell us about that.
Yes, with pneumonia vaccine, we are recommending that to especially everyone 65 plus, but also for individuals 50 plus. It's important to think about pneumonia, especially if you have chronic conditions, including diabetes, including heart, liver, lung disease. It increases your risk of pneumococcal pneumonia. And we kind of simplify by calling it the pneumonia vaccine, but it really protects against pneumococcal disease, which goes beyond pneumonia. Which pneumonia is a lung infection, but pneumococcal disease can cause infections in the lining of your brain and in your blood. And these more serious infections can lead to hospitalization and death.
Dr. Yang, Molly, is the pneumonia vaccine covered or we have to pay out of pocket for that one?
That is a great question. So in Ontario, if you're over the age of 65, there is one type of pneumonia vaccine that is covered called Pneumovax, which you can get at your doctor's office. But, you know, there has been in the past couple of years new vaccines that have come out. The one that we really recommend now is called Prevnar 20. And it includes 20 of the strains of protecting against pneumococcal pneumonia. It is a newer vaccine. It has better technology, and so there is better coverage. However, it's not provincially funded. So at this time, if you want to get Prevnar 20, you will have to pay for it. And it is a prescription vaccine, so you'll need to visit a prescriber. But your pharmacist with the prescription can administer it for you.
And about how much is it?
So you only need one dose of Prevnar 20, and the cost is around $150.
Okay. Now, the RSV vaccine, that is covered if you are a resident of a long-term care home in Ontario, but I think the rest of us have to pay, yes?
Yes, there is only limited funding for Arexvy, which is the RSV vaccine, but everyone over the age of 60 should talk to their pharmacist or to their prescriber about getting it. And again, there's limited provincial coverage, but if you go and get a prescription for it, your pharmacist would be able to administer it for you, and you can either pay cash or put it through your insurance plan.
And that one is how much?
That one is about $270.
Okay.
And it is one dose.
And one dose. And Shingrix, which I've had, is two doses. And
yes,
it is covered if you're between the ages of 65 and 69. Once you turn 70, it's no longer covered, yes?
Yes.
Okay. That one is expensive as well.
Yeah, so it is a two-dose series, and each dose is about maybe $160 to $180 each. But it is still very important to get the shingles vaccine, right? We think about shingles as that acute rash that people get, but you know, the vaccine prevents against that initial rash, but a lot of people can have complications as well, and it can cause things like chronic pain, and in some individuals, rarely, can cause things like blindness. And we know that it's very common. One in three people will have shingles in their lifetime, so it's important to at least think about getting these vaccines as soon as you turn 50, really.
Okay. Is it, if you're on a fixed income, if things are tight, is it okay to wait till you're 65, or should you somehow try to get the money together for that?
Yeah, you know, with every individual, ultimately, it is your personal choice. And I encourage you speaking with your pharmacist that you trust and your healthcare provider. But for me, you know, if I was speaking, for example, to a family member, I would always encourage to get the Shingrix vaccine as soon as possible because of how common shingles is, to protect against that intensely painful initial rash, but also the long-term complications of it. And we know that with the data from Shingrix, we have long-standing protection. So right now we have data for at least 10 years. So you know that it's going to be long protection that you have. And that data continues to evolve.
And it is covered if you have private health insurance through work or otherwise. We'll take one call and then we have to take a quick break. And then I promise we'll get back to everybody who has a question or comment for Dr. Yang. Let's go to John in Toronto. John, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Jane. I thought it'd be wise if I took the shingles vaccination, so I did, and then I carried out my business. And then I thought, oh, a year is coming up, so I better get the double dose, the second part of the two-dose vaccination. So I went in at 4 o'clock up at the family practice at the hospital, and everything was fine. Took the dose at 4 o'clock. 8 o'clock, I was flat on my back in bed wondering, should I call 911?
Wow.
But I didn't panic because I had spoken with Vera a month before, and she had the same exact situation with her second dose of the two-dose system. So I just lied there and just let it pass. So I just stared at the ceiling and then didn't panic. And I remember what Vera said. She was sick like a dog, but then the next day she was fine. And the next day for me, I was fine. But I went back to the hospital and I told them, I said, you know, for seniors, why don't you just tell them that you may have a complication on the second part of that two-dose virus?
Yeah. So, let me put that over to the pharmacist, and thank you for sharing your experience, John.
Okay, Jane, bye.
Molly, what about that? And I do remember, I can't remember whether it was the first or the second, but one, there was a more intense reaction.
Yeah, that's a great question, John, and I'm glad you brought it up. And first of all, thank you for getting your second dose. That's a big gap that a lot of people miss. You're not fully protected until you get both doses. But in terms of the adverse reactions after a vaccine, with Shingrix, it is one of the ones where it is most common that we hear that there are some, especially in the day or a couple days following your vaccine, some reactions to it, including, you know, the feeling of exhaustion or fever and feeling like, you know, a little bit under the weather. So we typically encourage after getting your shingles vaccine to give yourself some time, a couple days to rest, because it is quite common.
It is special programming in the second half of Fight Back. Jane for Libby, along with pharmacist Dr. Molly Yang, Director of Pharmacy Innovation and Professional Affairs at Whole Health Pharmacy Partners, a national group with over 200 pharmacies across Canada. We're talking about the Dose for Dose campaign as well as part of National Immunization Awareness Week. And we are back with more of your phone calls right after this quick break.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
During this National Immunization Awareness Week, we are speaking with pharmacist Dr. Molly Yang of Whole Health Pharmacy Partners, and we're about to take your phone calls. Are you ready, Dr. Yang? We've got a whole bunch of them here.
Yeah, perfect. Looking forward to it.
Okay. Una in Toronto, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm sorry, this question is not about one of the specific vaccines that are part of this campaign, but I was wondering about measles vaccines for people who were born before 1970. I don't think I had measles as a kid, and there was no vaccine at the time, and I'm just wondering, should I get it?
Right. Great question. Dr. Yang.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, we see with the recent outbreaks just how important immunization is from a local perspective, but also globally. Regarding the recent measles outbreaks, I believe, you know, if you're born before the age of 1970, there is that perception that you have that coverage, but you may need an additional booster dose. So what I would recommend is you speak to your prescriber, and generally these vaccines are not given at the pharmacy level, but either through public health or with the prescriber.
Okay, Una.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling. Jim in Pickering, you're on the air.
Wow, this just keeps getting more complicated. You know, you have to be a certain age to get, say, for example, the shingles vaccination. And then if you're over a certain age, which I am, I'm 77, you don't qualify for it. You know, I mean, it's too bad. It's so complicated for everything, right?
Yeah, Jim, you bring up a good point. Dr. Yang, there is a lot of different criteria around all of these shots that we're recommended to get.
No, yeah, I certainly agree with you. And, you know, it can be challenging, especially for patients and also for pharmacists and healthcare providers to decode as well, which is why I believe it's important to bring it up with your pharmacist, your healthcare provider, to do that inventory of which vaccines you're recommended. You know, it doesn't have to be annual, but at least doing it once, so then you're aware that, you know, these vaccines are recommended and why, so then you can plan for them.
I see from my notes here that Zeev has passed on. There are big vaccination gaps in our population. At least one in four Canadian adults are missing or unsure if they're missing a routine vaccine. And that's the, sort of what Jim was indicating there as well.
Right. Yeah, lots of, I think lack of awareness is probably the biggest issue that we deal with, right? In that people aren't aware that if there are vaccines that are not provincially funded, right, that they're still beneficial for you. So asking your healthcare providers about those, even if they're not covered.
And what about just thinking about the MMR vaccine that we got our children and that they need to get before they can continue with their schooling, in-person schooling, and the tetanus shot? Are we supposed to get a tetanus shot? It's once every 10 years or something like that.
Yes. So with the tetanus, you get a tetanus and diphtheria vaccine in adulthood, and then it's once every 10 years. But individuals who are pregnant are also eligible to receive another Tdap or tetanus diphtheria whooping cough vaccine when they're pregnant.
Let's go to Annie in Toronto. Annie, you're on the line here with Dr. Yang. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Yang. Thank you for actually bringing this topic up and bringing awareness, because it's a very important topic. I have a question. As there are so many vaccines and so many different, as the other caller brought up, different ages where you have to take them and if you have to repeat them, are you aware of any website where you can go in and you can actually put what you have been given over your course of your life, and then, you know, you put your age and then it tells you what you're missing or what needs updating? Is there such a thing out there where, because like I have three children, I constantly keep a record of them. However, I'm not sure if I need to update there. And of course, you know, with the shortage of family doctors out there, there's a shortage. So, you know, sometimes you can't find a doctor to help you with this, to navigate. And there's so much information on the internet. So it's kind of hard to navigate sometimes.
Annie, excellent. Dr. Yang, go ahead.
Yeah, that is a great question. And I think that is an issue that a lot of people are trying to solve right now, especially as the role, especially for pharmacy, as our role has changed throughout the pandemic as being one of the lead vaccinators in our communities. You know, for the time being, there are programs out there where you can input your vaccine history and they can keep the history and maybe make limited suggestions. But on a broader level where it's more complete, that is a question that is continually being developed. And I know there are programs that are being developed now, hopefully to help with this in the future.
Okay, let's go to Daryl in Toronto. Not sure if it's the same Daryl from the first half hour. Hello.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, Daryl, go ahead.
Okay.
I had a quick question. I'm currently 69, will be 70 in the summer. When I was 65, I got the previous shingles shot, which was a one-dose one. And apparently, because of that, I'm not eligible for the new one, the more recent one.
That is a great question, Daryl, because I can remember my doctor saying years ago, before there was the double, that you should wait till you're about 60 to get that shot that you're talking about. But now the double shot, and Dr. Yang, you can confirm this, you can get that early, right after you turn 50.
Yes. So, Daryl, exactly what you said is correct. Unfortunately, if you did receive the Zostavax in the past, the one-dose vaccine, you are not eligible to get publicly funded Shingrix now. However, it is still, I would still recommend you to get the Shingrix vaccine because we see such great effectiveness and long-lasting effectiveness with the two-dose Shingrix vaccine. It's the updated technology that makes it more effective. Whereas with the previous shot, it still provided protection, but within the first couple of years, we saw there was waning. So it's important if you have received the Shingrix vaccine or the previous shingles Zostavax vaccine in the past to think about the Shingrix, the two dose now.
Okay, Daryl.
Suggestion to the government is in a situation like this, they should make me pay for the last one that I got and then give me the new ones.
It's
the better one.
Yeah. That is not a bad idea. Thank you for calling. We're coming to the end of our half hour here with pharmacist Dr. Molly Yang. And if you missed the first part of the show, I just want to go over again the whole health pharmacy campaign called Dose for Dose. Just recap for us what it's all about, Dr. Yang.
Yes, thanks. Thanks, Jane. And, for Dose, we are excited to launch this campaign across our 220-plus pharmacies across Canada, in which each dose of an eligible vaccine, including HPV, meningitis, shingles, RSV, and pneumonia vaccines, will result in a dose of measles, polio, or tetanus vaccine donated to children worldwide. And through this campaign, we're hoping to educate and address vaccination gaps locally across Canada, while also giving back and fostering global health.
Do we have an idea when we look globally at how many children or what percentage of children are unvaccinated in developing nations and third world countries?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jane. And we see even locally within Canada, there are huge vaccination gaps for adults and children. But when we're looking at a global scale, at least one in five children does not have access to these essential life-saving vaccines, right? These are measles, polio, tetanus vaccines, which are really important. So we're hoping that with this campaign to be able to contribute to that.
And so as part of it, the 30,000 vaccinations for children around the world, you are giving these vaccines to UNICEF and then they are administering them. Is that how it works?
Yes, correct. So we provide a financial donation and UNICEF Canada and UNICEF, which they operate in over 100 countries worldwide, will be giving the vaccines to the most vulnerable populations.
And you can find more information online about the campaign and about what vaccines you should have at wholehealthpharmacy.ca/dose4dose, the number 4, wholehealthpharmacy.ca/dose4dose. This has been very interesting, Dr. Yang. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on your show.
Dr. Molly Yang is a pharmacist and director of pharmacy innovation and professional affairs at Whole Health Pharmacy Partners, national group with over 200 pharmacies across Canada. Jane for Libby, and make sure you join me tomorrow for Free for All Friday. Grab a line during Bob's noon news, and it's your show, your agenda. Speaking of which, the news is next, and then the number one's at one.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.